We're going to be talking about money today. Money, money, money. If you're going to build a house, one thing it takes is money. And you better do some careful planning, because if you don't, you're going to have a lot of cost overruns and unexpected expenses. And it's no different when you're building a home. So how are we going to finance our extreme home makeover? How are we going to make sure that we end up with a happy, healthy home rather than a financial train wreck? Managing money does not come easily for a lot of us. Now, I know some of you are naturally frugal types. In fact, I've met a few over the years that are so tight that they have to go to a proctologist just to let go of a dollar bill. But most of us aren't that way. Most of us are like the former pro golfer Doug Sanders, who said, "I am working as hard as I can to get my life and my money to run out at the same time. If I can die after lunch on Tuesday, everything will be just fine," he said. If current statistics tell us anything, they tell us that a lot of us have a really hard time managing money. Consider this. The average household debt in America is $90,000. But that includes all kinds of debt. If we just narrow that down to credit card debt, it's a little over $8,000 per family. But that includes all those families that have no credit card debt, which is about half of the American families. If you look at only households that have credit card debt, that average goes up to $16,000. That means we are paying $1,300 a year just in interest alone. Our debt load as Americans, as consumers, is about to surpass what it was before the Great Recession 10 years ago. And that's just as average Americans. That does not count the government debt. Which tells me we really haven't learned a thing. Almost half of us spend more than we make each year. And personal bankruptcies now account for all but 3% of bankruptcies. The truth is, we live life like a country song. Maybe you've heard the Marty Stewart song, "I paid the bank note, the car note, and yes, I paid the phone bill too. And then I turned around and found that the house note's due. Well, I'd love to take you out like I said I would, honey, but there's too much month. The end of the money, that's right." And the stress of these financial burdens is pulling our homes apart. Money worries are the number one cause of conflict in the home. One study recently done by SunTrust Bank found that 35% of all couples fight regularly about money. And also, is now the leading cause of divorce. 51 out of every 100 couples that get divorced point to money problems as one of the primary contributing factors. And what makes all of this so amazing to me is that compared to the rest of the world, we are filthy rich. Let me ask you some questions, and you just kind of keep a mental checklist and answer yes or no, all right? Do you have a television? Yes or no? Do you have a cell phone? Do you have more than 2 changes of clothes? Do you have something to eat, at least 1 meal every day? Do you have a car? Do you have a roof over your head and a place to sleep at night? Do you have electricity? If you answered yes to those questions, then you are richer than the vast majority of the world. Let me put some actual numbers to this. Let's just say that you make $3,000 a year. That's all you make in a whole year, $3,000. That would make you extremely poor in the United States. That is 75% below the poverty level. It would also make you among the richest 30% of people in the world. Does that give you some perspective on where we are? I hope that it does. Now, I realize there are some money problems that we can't control. We get laid off. We have an unexpected surgery. We total the car. But we also love to play the victim. We love to wallow in this attitude of, well, I can't help it. It's not really my fault. And many of the things that we can't control wouldn't be a problem if we just learn to wisely manage the money that we do make. Let me say something that might sound absurd to you, but it's true. Most of our money problems aren't because we don't make enough money. Now, making more money helps, absolutely. But the truth is this, if you can't manage $20,000 a year very well, you're not going to manage $100,000 a year very well. It's a biblical principle. Jesus talked about it. He who is faithful in a few things is faithful in many. And if you can't be entrusted with a little bit, then you can't be entrusted with a lot. See, if you don't manage money well, you will never make enough money. This is why we regularly see articles about professional athletes who just a year, two, three, after retiring from the big leagues, are broke. They have to declare bankruptcy. And you're like, how is that even possible? You were making $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, $15 million a year. How are you broke? Because they don't know how to manage money. It's not an income thing. It's a money management thing. It's an attitude thing. And I realize there are exceptions to this, but I want to give you some encouragement today. And I want to give you some biblical principles, some priorities that will help give you some perspective on money. And the bottom line is there are only three things that you can do with money. Only three things. You can spend it. You can save it. And you can share it. And for most Americans, that's exactly what we do with it in that order. First, we spend it. We buy stuff and pay bills. And then if there's anything left over after that, we might save some. And then if we have anything left over after that, we might share it. Give some to the church or to a charity. But I want to share with you today four key principles of money management from the greatest money management expert in the universe, God Himself. And these principles cannot fail because they have God's guarantee that they work. Because He's the one that created the world. He knows how it works. But number one, be correct in how you see money. We have to have a correct view of money. 1 Timothy 6:7 says, for we brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. When you were born, you came into this world with nothing. When you die, you know what you're taking with you? Nothing. Now, I was reading in the paper just last week about how these European researchers have used modern technology and they think they have found a hidden chamber in King Tut's tomb. And they're hoping to open that hidden chamber this next year. King Tut and the Egyptian pharaohs thought they could take it with them. Guess what? They couldn't, and they didn't. Now, preachers used to say, you never see a Hertz pulling a U-Haul. Have you heard that one before? I can't say it anymore. Throw that picture up on the screen. That's right up there on Glenstone, just south of 44. But bottom line still remains, you can't take it with you. And if we brought nothing into the world, and then in a few years when we die and we can't take any of it with us, then who really owns it in this time in between? The house that you live in, the place that you call my house, a few years ago for most of us, somebody else called it my house. And a few years from now, somebody else is going to call it my house. You see, the bottom line is that we are just temporary managers of things that really aren't ours. We have such an upside down view of money. We figure the money is ours and that God's money is what we put in the plate on Sunday. But God's view of money is something entirely different. In 1 Corinthians 10:26, Paul quotes Psalm 24:1, which says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." And I read it this week in like five different translations. And not in one of them did it say, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it except for Dan's stuff." I was looking for that in the Hebrew or the Greek somewhere. Couldn't find it. Didn't say, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it except for your stuff." You see, the biblical reality is that it's all His. God owns everything, including everything you and I possess, because He created it. We brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out of it because it was never ours to begin with. And whether it's gold or silver or greenbacks or bitcoins, it's all His. We only get to manage it for a time. When Lyndon Johnson was president, he was at an Air Force base. And he was going out to his helicopter, I think it's called Marine One. The only problem was that on the tarmac there were dozens of helicopters. And he started going to the wrong helicopter. And the young Air Force sergeant that was with him tried to correct him, "Mr. President, this is your helicopter." And Lyndon Johnson looked at him and said, "Son, they are all my helicopters." Well, for 4 years. See, even the president doesn't get to take it with him. In the Old Testament, one part of worship was bringing animal sacrifices. And there were times that the Israelite people were tempted to think that somehow God needed their animals. And they were led to think that they were somehow doing God this great big favor by bringing in their bull or their lamb for sacrifice. Here's what God told them in Psalm 50, verses 9 through 12. "But I want no more bulls from your barns. I want no more goats from your pens. For the animals of the forest are mine. And I own the cattle on 1,000 hills. Every bird of the mountains and all the animals of the field belong to me." And do you hear what God is saying there? He says, it doesn't matter whether it's the animals in the barns, or the animals in the pens, or the wild animals out in the fields of the mountains. They're all mine, God says. We will always struggle with money until we get a correct view on just whose it is. You see, our problem with money is not usually a head issue. It's a heart issue. We know that we should save money. But we don't save it because our heart's not in the right place. We know that we shouldn't spend more than we make, but we keep swiping that plastic because our heart's not in the right place. It's a heart problem, not a head problem. And so we need to have a correct view. We need to see it correctly. Number two, we need to be committed in how we share money. We need to be committed in how we share money. In Acts 20:35, Paul quotes a statement of Jesus that flies in the face of our culture. He says, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." And I really like how the Message puts it. It says, "You are far happier giving than getting." Really? Is that true? Are we more excited at offering time on Sunday than we are at payday? What's he talking about here? How does this work? But you know, once we see money correctly, then we're going to understand the real question is not how much of my money am I going to give to God. The real question is how much of God's money am I going to keep for myself? Now, if you're following along there in your outline and you're ready to fill in some blanks, I'm skipping over some stuff here. Because out of the 4 points of the sermon, the one that's maybe the hardest for us to get is this one. This is the one that goes mostly against the grain of our culture. And so we're going to take a whole week to look at this one next Sunday. So I'm just going to give you a bird's eye view here today. But remember earlier I said there's only three things you can do with money. You can spend it, you can save it, you can share it. And that most people do it in that order. But God's view is the exact opposite. God says the first thing you should do with money is to share it, to give it. And then you should save it. And then you should spend it. You see, instead of giving God our leftovers, God wants us to honor Him first as an act of worship. And then God responds to our giving by personally getting involved in our finances. In Philippians chapter 4, Paul thanks the Philippian church for their generous giving. You see, they had taken up a donation and they sent this very generous donation to help support Paul's ministry, and they sent it through a man by the name of Epaphroditus. And Paul is thanking them for their generosity, their sharing. And right after he says this thanks, he then gives them this promise. And my God will supply every need of yours according to His riches and glory in Christ Jesus. Philippians 4:19, we love that verse. We love to quote that verse. My God will supply all of your needs according to His riches and glory. The problem is, almost every time I hear that verse quoted, it's never quoted in context. It's never quoted in the context of generous giving. And sometimes if we wonder why God doesn't supply our needs, maybe it is because we haven't first honored Him and shared with Him with what He's already given us. Proverbs 3, 9 and 10 says, honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing and your vats will brim over with new wine. And the idea of first fruits was simply this, that when harvest time comes, you take some of the first of your harvest, the first of the crops that come in, and you give God of the first and of the best, not the leftovers. We should give to God off of the top. Our giving should be the first line in the family budget. And in so doing, we are inviting God to involve Himself personally in our finances. And one of the reasons the vast majority of people, even in the church, have such a hard time managing their money is because they don't really have God involved in their finances. He's not really the Lord of how they spend money. Number one, we need to be correct in how we see money. Number two, we need to be committed in how we share money. Number three, we need to be consistent in how we save money. Now, Proverbs 21:20 says, the wise store up choice food and olive oil, but fools gulp theirs down. Solomon is saying here, if you don't save for the future, you're a fool. Ouch. But the principle is this, don't spend and consume everything that you make. You should save some for future needs. As Americans, we have the highest standard of living in the world, but we are so bad at saving money. Last year, the savings rate was 5.7%, and that's actually better than it's been in recent years. In recent years, it has been as low as zero. We weren't saving anything. But 5% isn't enough. Money experts tell us we need to be saving 10 to 15% of our income for emergencies and for retirement. And I read a figure, and this just shocked me when I read it. 85% of Americans have less than $250 in cash when they reach the age of 65. Whoa. Husband had been sitting at a calculator for 3 hours. Without saying a word. Finally, he looked up and he said to his wife, he says, honey, if we continue to save at our present rate, by the time I retire, we're going to owe $700,000. And do you know why? This lack of savings is why we are wiped out by unexpected events. Money Magazine says that almost 80% of us will have a major negative economic event in any given 10-year period. So, a job loss, a major surgery, you total a car, terrorists blow up your washer and dryer, you know, something like that. But you're going to have a negative event. And see, here's the thing. Unexpected events really aren't unexpected, are they? We know they're going to happen. We just don't know exactly when or what. But we know they're coming. So why aren't we saving for them? It's a disaster waiting to happen. That's why after you pay God first, then you need to pay yourself second. Do everything you can to be saving at least 10% of your income. And if you can't afford that, start with 5%. And if you don't think you can do that, then I challenge you to look through your month and find some places where you're spending some money you really don't need to spend. Maybe it's McDonald's or Starbucks or Bed Bath & Beyond or Newegg, something. And save some money. Now, I'm going to share with something with you that could change your lives. And teenagers, I know you're looking at your phones and stuff, but I need you to pay attention for just a little bit here. Because this could change your life. Now, last week I gave you teenagers some counsel about relationships and guarding your sexual purity. And I said if you do that, it could change your life. If you do this too, not only will it change your life, it could change your family tree, your legacy. When I first saw what I'm about to share with you, I was in my late 30s. And my first thought was, why? Why, oh, why didn't somebody share this with me when I was 17, 18, 19 years old? But I'm going to show you how you become millionaires with just several thousand dollars. And this, I get this, is from Dave Ramsey, his Financial Peace University. But this is the tale of Ben and Arthur, two friends. So go ahead and throw up the chart there. But Ben and Arthur, and you probably can't see that. You don't need to see all of that. But Ben, when he was 19 years old, after he graduated from high school, decided he was going to start investing money. And he put $2,000 a year into a mutual fund, a good, solid mutual fund with a good track record. And he did that every year for 8 years. And then for some reason, when he was 27, he just stopped. Now, he didn't take any money out. He let it continue to grow. Arthur, meanwhile, did what most of us do in our late teens and throughout our 20s. We kind of dork around, you know, try to figure out what we want to do with life. So he didn't get serious about things till he was 27 years old. And then he started investing $2,000 a year every year. And he continued to do it up until he retired at 65. Who do you think had the most money when they retired? Ben. Because he started earlier. Now, some of you out there who are like investing gurus or number crunchers, you're going to say, well, that's kind of an idealistic view. And it is. That's based on the average historic returns of the stock market, and every year is the same. And in reality, there are up years, there are down years, and it doesn't take into account things like standard deviation and the importance of dollar cost averaging and blah, 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 blah. But it does illustrate two very important principles. One is the power of compound interest, getting interest on top of interest on top of interest, and also the importance of starting early. And you get started early, this can change your life. And I'm going to tell you how easy this can be, and I'll give you a very personal illustration, and it's okay. Alyssa's not here today, but I did call her and get her permission. When we saw this, we were in our 30s, and I couldn't find a time machine to go back when I was 19. But I did look in my house, and I realized I had a couple of young girls, and I thought, we can get them started off on the right foot. And so we did. We took some money out of our savings, $500 for each girl, and we started each one of them in just a simple index fund tied to the S&P 500 and got them started in a mutual fund at $500 each. And I'll pick on Alyssa from here on out. From that point, every month when they got their allowance, we put half of it into the mutual fund. And now, it wasn't a lot of money. It was just $10 a month. That was it. We put $10 a month into that fund. And then we encouraged the girls. We didn't make them. We encouraged them that whenever they got Christmas money or birthday money or babysitting money, to take some of that and invest it. She did. And so, after a couple of years, that $500 became $1,000. And at that point, we took that fund, we took half of it out, and we diversified it. We put half of it into an international stock fund. And then it continued to grow. We continued to put in tiny little bits at a time. When it got to $2,000, we did two things. Number one, we split it into three, and we put a third of it into a small company stock fund. And so what we were doing is we were trying to teach her the principle of diversification. The other thing we did at that point is we told her, okay, we've gotten you off to a good start. We've given you a foundation. It's all on you now. So we haven't helped since $2,000. Not a penny. But Alyssa's continued to put some in here and there. And she doesn't work a lot, maybe 10 hours a week. But she's really good about how she spends money and how she saves money. So this last Christmas break, she comes home and she's like, Dad. I was like, what? She goes, my mutual funds are worth $4,000 now. Because I want to diversify again. Okay, well, what do you want to do? We talked about it, researched it, and she decided she wanted to put some money in real estate. So at 20 years old, this girl's already investing in a real estate fund. And she had done so good saving money, she was actually able to take $500 out of savings and just put it towards this real estate fund. That's incredible. And Alyssa told me, she says, you know, I try to talk to my friends in college about it and their eyes just glaze over. It just goes right over their heads. They have no idea what I'm talking about. They just don't care. And she goes, and none of them have any money. But I want you guys to know you can do this. And it can make a huge difference. And it can be easy. I mean, we started off with just a little bit and just a tiny little bit at a time. And it makes a huge difference. So we need to be consistent in how we save money. Number four, we need to be cautious in how we spend money. 1 Timothy 6:6 says, but godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. A lot of us have spending habits that could be cured by one word, contentment. You see, a lot of people, even in the church, think, well, once you give to God, then the rest of the money is yours to do with whatever you want. But we need to remember that it's all His. The rest of the money is just an expense account that God has given us. And we're going to have to give an account to Him someday for that. You can be rich in one of two ways. In how much you have or in how little you want. And most of us need to learn to be satisfied with more of what we have and a little less of what we want. Ecclesiastes 6:9 says, enjoy what you have rather than desiring what you don't have. Ooh. The average person spends money quickly and impulsively and foolishly. We finance things that are immediately worth 30 to 40% less the minute we exit the store. Proverbs 22:7 says, the borrower is slave to the lender. We have become slaves to financial institutions that don't even know our names. They don't care anything about you other than your money. You are nothing more to them than an account number and a dollar sign on their bottom line, but they rule your life. We spend hours fighting over this stuff. They rule our lives. We spend hours asleep or awake at night instead of sleeping because we're worried about finances. They rule our lives. The best way to be cautious about spending your money, I'm just going to give you two things here. First, plan your spending. And number two, dump your debt. Plan your spending. This is simply, I'm talking about having a budget here. And if budget sounds like a scary word to you, then just call it a spending plan. But know where your dollars are going to go before you spend them. Otherwise, you're going to wonder where they went. Don't let impulse and temptation be the driving forces of your finances. Proverbs 21:5 says, plan carefully and you will have plenty. If you act too quickly, you will never have enough. So be cautious in how you spend money. And if you need some help getting started with budgeting, I put a little link there at the bottom of that outline to help get you started. One word of caution, though. Couples, do this together. Please don't one husband or wife on their own go off and do this budgeting thing on their own and then try to force it on your spouse. It's not going to work. Nothing but heartache and fights. You've got to do this together. Plan your spending, and then the other thing you need to do is dump your debt. Remember, the only person looking out for your best interest is you. The credit card company isn't looking out for your interest. Oh, they want your interest at 18 to 25%. One of the best things you can do to get control of your money and spend it wisely is to dump your debt. So you give to God first, you share, then you set aside some for emergencies, you save, and then go after that debt. And I know just based on statistics, there are some of us here this morning that are drowning in debt, and we have no idea how we're ever going to get out of it. I want to show you a real quick video. And I've shared with you some stuff from Dave Ramsey, and this is from Dave Ramsey. This is something called the debt snowball, and it can get you out of debt very quickly. Go ahead and throw that video.
When I was a kid growing up, I used to love being out in the snow, playing in it, having snowball fights, building snowmen, whatever. Now, as any kid can tell you, there are two ways to build a snowman. You can grab handfuls of snow, build him from the ground up like a nincompoop, or you can roll a small snowball around the yard, and before you know it, voila, snow torso, then lather, rinse, repeat, and add two sticks and a carrot. Dave Ramsey's philosophy of the debt snowball works on the same principle. You can try to eliminate your debt handfuls at a time, or you can allow your debt payments to snowball and you can beat your debt down like that pleated high water wearing clarinet player after gym class. Here's how it works. Step one is to find $200 in your budget that isn't designated for anything. How will you find $200? That's entirely up to you. Sell something. Sell anything you don't need, like your weightlifting set or your Monogram Paula Deen diabetes baking kit. Maybe you need to eliminate your cable TV, dining out, or your $4.50 a day morning dose of price gouging, disappointingly tasteless caffeine. Now that you have that, your next step is to list all your debts in increasing order of how much you owe. In this example, we have $450 owed to Lowe's for the new grill that you just had to have. $650 for Target for your shoes, your belt, and your purse, the essential matching set, and your flat screen TV. Then there's a $1,600 you owe to your parents for that time your transmission went out on your sweet vintage 98 Accord, and so on. Make a list of all the debts you have, lowest to highest. The next step is where the snowball starts. We're going to pay the minimum payment on all the debts, for now, except the one with the smallest balance. For the lowest card, we'll pay the minimum payment of $50 plus the $200 that we found. So guess what? After 2 months of paying $250, your Lowe's debt is gone. Next, we'll take that $250 you were paying Lowe's and snowball into the minimum payment of your Target card. So now we are paying $280 a month, and after a couple more months, just like magic, your Target card is paid off. You continue this process each time, snowballing your old payments into your new payments like Buddy the Elf. And for long, all of your debts are gone. Now, an important thing to note is that during this process, you have to keep the snowball rolling for it to work. So no matter how much you love that new Urban Outfitters overpriced dress or the toolbox, or that new TV to replace the one you smashed in a fit of anger after stupid Kobe missed that stupid game-winning free throw after, oh my goodness, why the Lakers suck so bad this year? You have to wait. The debt snowball is the fastest, most effective way to tackle a lot of debt and pay it off quickly. Using the examples we had, if you were to pay the minimum balance on all the loans you had, it would take you 120 months before the debt was paid. That is 10 years. 10 years of playing Jean Valjean to the bank's inspector Javert. But if you use the debt snowball, you can have all these debts paid off in just 21 months. That's less than 2 years. That's 99 more months of freedom. And additionally, if you take that $1,100 that you were snowballing and invest it at 8% interest for those 99 months, you'd have $153,000. So let's do this like Pastor used to do. Take the debt, roll it up, and smoke it.
All right, apologies to all band geeks in that one, especially if you play clarinet. We will never manage money properly until we're correct in how we see money, until we're committed in how we share it, until we are consistent in how we save it, and we are cautious in how we spend it. There's one final question I need to raise, or you really won't get this. And the question is not who owns the money. The question is, who owns you? In the verse I read earlier, Proverbs 24:1, says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." But that's not the whole verse. The verse goes on, "And the world and all who live in it." Twice, Paul reminds the Corinthians, you were bought with a price. See, it's not just that all the stuff is his, but if you are a Christian, it's his because you belong to him. A missionary was working in a faraway land and he was talking to a chief of a tribe about Jesus. And the chief tried to impress the missionary with gifts of horses and blankets and jewelry. And the missionary looked at the chief and he said, "My God does not want the chief's horses or blankets or jewelry. My God wants the chief himself." And the chief smiled and said, "You have a very wise God, for when I give myself to that God, he will also get my horses, my blankets, and my jewelry." Jesus Christ has a claim on you. He signed it in his blood. He died on the cross, not just to pay for your sins, but to pay for you. He was raised from the dead that he might come into your life and not just help manage your money, but to manage your life. This is what we mean when we talk about Jesus being the Lord of your life. He's going to be the manager of it all. The boss of everything. And the God who owns everything, the whole world and everything in it, wants to own you as well. Not as some sort of vicious taskmaster, but as a loving Lord and Savior. So my question for you this morning is, who has you? Because whoever has you, that's also who has all your stuff too. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up here to lead us in our song of invitation and commitment. And I'm going to be right outside these doors. Pastor Kelly will be outside these doors. We'll have an elder in the back. And if you need somebody to pray with you this morning, if you're looking to make Sunrise your church home, you've got questions about baptism, you want to make Jesus the Lord of your life, come back and talk to us and we would be happy to share with you. Would you be standing as we sing?